Here in the third hour of Issues Etc., we're going to talk about the link between abortion and breast cancer. It's a subject that is taken up in a new book called The Cost of Choice. Our guest, Dr. Angela Lanfranchi, has written a chapter in that book along with many others, and we've been interviewing them for the last couple of weeks. Her title of her chapter is The Abortion Breast Cancer Link, The Studies and the Science. And we'll be talking about both the studies and the science in the course of this conversation. Feel free to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Lanfranchi is also Assistant Clinical Professor of Surgery at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and co-founder of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute. Dr. Lanfranchi, welcome back.
Thank you.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, this link, I've read about it in the papers, I've read about it in the news magazines, it sounds like something cooked up by pro-lifers just to scare women about abortion?
Well, what I would say is that you can't, the reason that it hasn't died, it hasn't gone away, is because it's based on our biology. It's based on the physiology of the breast and how it reacts to the hormones of pregnancy. And so if you look at women who have premature deliveries before 32 weeks, there are several studies in the literature that say any premature delivery before 32 weeks of gestation more than doubles breast cancer risk. Well, why would that be? Well, in the first two trimesters of pregnancies, your breasts get enlarged, they get tender and sore, and what you're doing is increasing the number of immature type 1 and 2 lobules, and that's where cancers start. It's only after 32 weeks that the hormones of pregnancy differentiate those type 1 and 2 lobules into cancer-resistant type 3 lobules. So if the pregnancy ends in a premature delivery before 32 weeks, you've left that woman with more places for breast cancers to start than if she had never been pregnant at all. So no one disagrees with that.
That is just the basic, commonly agreed upon mechanism of how the whole physiology works.
Of the breast works. So what is an abortion? An abortion is a physician-induced premature delivery before 32 weeks. And physiologically, it's equivalent, with the exception of miscarriages in the first trimester, because those types of miscarriages, the spontaneous abortions, the miscarriages in the first trimester, usually occur in women with low estrogen levels, and so their breasts don't respond by multiplying those type 1 and 2 lobules. So their breasts don't end up different than before the start of the pregnancy. So, there's a physiologic link, and then you just have to, the facts just kind of stare you in the face. You know, in 1975, the risk of developing breast cancer for American women was 1 in 12. Now it's 1 in 7. Now something, our genes haven't changed in just 30 years, but our lifestyle has. So it's more than just abortion that has contributed to that increase in risk, but it's there. So often when I will tell somebody about it or people will listen to a lecture I'm giving, they'll say, oh, yeah, well, that explains it. My 26-year-old sister-in-law had an abortion at 17 before she married my brother. And when women hear this, often they'll know somebody in their circle of friends or somebody at work or somebody in the neighborhood that was quite young when they got breast cancer that did have an abortion in their history.
Let's talk about, and you discuss this in your chapter in the book, The Cost of Choice, about how to determine the criteria by which one determines whether or not a real causal link exists between this and that.
Which, all right.
Between, let's say, for the sake of argument, between smoking and lung cancer, how, other than just saying, it seems like it makes sense that the two would be related, how do medical research and others, how do they determine whether a real causal link exists?
Okay, what you're referring to is how do we know when we do an epidemiologic study that it shows an association between a particular behavior and the outcome of a particular disease, how they're related? So if you did a study, you might find that people who carry matches in their pockets are more likely that they get lung cancer. But we know that matches don't cause lung cancer. It's because people who smoke cigarettes are more likely to have matches in their pocket. And we know that it's the benzopyrenes in cigarette smoke that induce the lung cancers. So that's why if you say, oh, just because there's an association between abortion and breast cancer doesn't make it true, doesn't make it the cause. Well, in fact, there are some criteria that we can use to make us realize, yes, it is a causal factor. The first is that you have to have the preponderance of the studies. So at this point, there are about 40 studies, and probably about 32 show a link between abortion and breast cancer and a positive association. Then there has to be statistically significant studies, and we have 17 statistically significant studies in the world literature, 8 of which were done in the United States that show breast cancer is associated with abortion. And then we have to have one of the most important ones, I think, is that we have to have a biologic principle that explains the risk. And the physiology of the breast has been worked out very well. I mean, all these cancer organizations are always saying, well, give us more money because we don't know what causes breast cancer, and yet we do know what causes breast cancer. One of the things that causes breast cancer is exposure to estrogen. So the more menstrual cycles we have in our life with the elevation of estrogen during the menstrual cycle, the more our risk of breast cancer. We have the biologic basis of abortion and breast cancer. It's been proven experimentally in animals. Rats who have their pregnancies terminated when they're given a chemical that induces breast cancer in these rats, 78% of them will get breast cancer, whereas the rats that have been allowed to go through a full-term pregnancy before they got the chemical that causes breast cancer don't get breast cancer. So the rats have enjoyed this full maturation of their breast tissue to cancer-resistant breast tissue. You have to have a significant elevation in risks, and there are some subsets of women that have a very high elevation in risk. The ones that are most susceptible are the women whose breasts are already growing, are in that proliferative state where the cells are multiplying and dividing. They're growing. They're teenagers. And teenagers who have abortions in the second trimester have a 30% chance of developing breast cancer in their lifetime. And if you think about it, the longer you're pregnant, the more of these immature lobules you've made, and the more likely you are to increase your risk of breast cancer simply because there are more places for breast cancers to start.
So this whole thing, you come back to this again and again so we can understand this, that in pregnancy, a woman's body is preparing to nurse a baby at some point. And in the physiology that's occurring there within her body, if this is either... if this is terminated with an abortion or through some other means, at this point, at this critical in these critical points of pregnancy, the her body has not finished doing what it needs to do, and it's left in this very susceptible state for cancer. In other words, the preponderance of these cells that are susceptible are going to increase her risk.
Everybody knows that the earlier you go through a full-term pregnancy in your life, the lower your risk of breast cancer. So compared to a woman who has her first child at 30, a woman who has her first child at 18 has a 75% reduction in risk of developing breast cancer. So a full-term pregnancy lowers breast cancer risk. Women who never have a child, who never maturate their breast tissue into type 3 lobules, they have a 90% increased risk of breast cancer. So that's one of the other epidemiological principles that the abortion breast cancer literature supports. It's coherent. The same coherent principles that cause other things to be risk factors causes abortion to be a risk factor for breast cancer.
You also write that there should be a dose effect. That is, the risk...
A dose effect, what that means is the more cigarettes you smoke, the more of this benzopyrene you get exposed to, the higher your risk of lung cancer. In the dose effect as it concerns abortion literature is the longer you're pregnant before you have the abortion, the higher your risk. So Melby in his 1997 study showed that for each week gestation, there was a 3% increased risk of breast cancer. So that second trimester abortions in his studies did significantly increase breast cancer risk. And what happens with teenagers tend to go into denial, and they don't start kind of confronting the fact that they are pregnant until they're starting to show. So many of the second trimester abortions are being done on teenagers. And these are the women that are showing up at 26 with breast cancer.
We're talking with Dr. Angela Lanfranchi, Assistant Clinical Professor of Surgery at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, co-founder of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute, and author of a chapter in the book, The Cost of Choice. Dr. Lanfranchi's chapter is titled, The Abortion Breast Cancer Link, Studies and the Science. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. You also point in connection with that whole dose effect that... Whereas with cigarettes, and everyone's worried about cigarette smoking, as they should rightly be, tens of thousands of cigarettes need to be smoked in order to increase the risk, but only one abortion can significantly increase a woman's risk for breast cancer.
That's correct, especially abortions before a full-term pregnancy. Those are the ones that will increase your risk the most. And the longer you go between that abortion and a full-term pregnancy, the more likely you will get breast cancer.
Let's deal with some of the arguments that you have heard, that you have been pressed into responding to, against the abortion breast cancer link. And we're going to begin with the one that I think makes the least sense to me, so explain it to us. It's called recall bias, and it's something that's a legitimate factor in all research. What is the argument here when they say, look, the problem with this abortion breast cancer link is that all the research that seems to prove it really suffers from fatal recall bias?
Okay, recall bias is an hypothesis that says women who are healthy and well, when they're being questioned by researchers, when they're asked if they've had an abortion, will not admit to having an abortion because they find it embarrassing or it's not accepted behavior. So the women who are healthy will say, no, I never had an abortion. But women who are sick with cancer are more likely to say, yeah, you know, I did have an abortion. Because when you have cancer, you're facing your own mortality. You want to know what could have contributed to it. You're more likely to be honest. That's the hypothesis. And if that were true, when you did a study, it would look like more people with breast cancer had an abortion history than women who did not. And it would be fought for that reason. But there have been studies specifically looking for this, and they haven't found it. And I'll give you one example. In 1991 in Sweden, they have a Swedish abortion registry. Then they also have a cancer registry. So they matched up the names. So they knew who in the registry had abortions and who in the cancer registry had cancer. And they went to these women and they interviewed them to see what they would say. And what they found out was that there were people who would, quote, over-report, meaning that they would say they had an abortion even though that they weren't in the cancer registry. So instead of saying, well, geez, our registry must be imperfect and not have everybody who's had an abortion in it, they said instead these women were admitting to abortions that they never had. And that was how they got a statistically significant difference between the two groups of women that had cancer and didn't have cancer.
It sounds as though...
And clearly that's preposterous. So that came out in 1991. So finally, through some letters to the editor, to the New England Journal, the authors admitted, yeah, that was a faulty conclusion. But in the meantime, that study had been out for several years, so everybody says, oh, the Swedish study shows that there's recall bias. There is not. And there were other studies that internally controlled for recall bias that didn't find it. They would ask, see if people admitted to cervical cancer and abortion and see if there was an association, and there wasn't. The other thing is, look, there's lots of things that people do in life that might be considered embarrassing, but when people agree to be part of the study, in general, they do tell the truth. So if you went to a woman and you said to her, how many sexual partners have you had? The more partners she's had, the more likely she will get cervical cancer because she's more likely to have gotten the human papillomavirus. Well, they found that out. Women didn't lie about how many partners they've had. When they were looking about to discover what caused HIV transmission, men admitted to having anal intercourse. People admitted to drinking a lot, and that's what gave them liver cirrhosis. So there's lots of potentially embarrassing behavior that people do tell researchers when they're trying to discover the cause of a disease.
We're talking with Dr. Angela Lanfranchi. She is co-founder of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute. Their website, by the way, it's bcpinstitute.org, bcpinstitute.org. Let's talk a little bit about that. It sounds as though that Swedish study, later discounted by its own authors, were actually hypothesizing that women over-report abortions?
Well, what happened was they tried to get a difference between the two groups. And the only way they got a statistically significant difference between the two groups, if they included these patients that admitted to having abortions that weren't in the abortion registry. So they said those women were mistaken or lying. They found a very small difference of people who underreported their abortions, who denied their abortions that had them. The difference between the two groups was 16% compared to 23%. And that difference of reporting in the two groups was not enough to change the outcome of a large study. So that's why recall bias hasn't been found to dramatically change these statistics. It just doesn't happen that much.
And when the researchers who are attempting to establish whether or not there is a link between abortion and breast cancer, when they do their research, I would assume, given this criticism, they are going to control for recall bias.
Yes, there are several studies that control for recall bias, like Janet Daling controls for recall bias by also asking talking to patients with cervical cancer and asking them about their abortion history. And they didn't find people underreported their abortion history.
What is this Melby study? You mentioned it before, and
okay.
I've heard it put forward as kind of an open and shut case against the link between abortion and breast cancer.
Yeah, that's the way that's how it was presented. Patricia Hartke, who is an epidemiologist at the National Cancer Institute, said this was a flawless study. This was the best study ever done, the biggest study ever done, and women didn't have to be concerned about this anymore. And the study came out about 6 months after Joel Brin published his meta-analysis showing a link between abortion and breast cancer. At that time, there were 23 studies supporting the abortion breast cancer link. The Danish study said, okay, we took all of the women in Denmark, and that was, I think it was 2.4 million women. But not all of them had abortions, right? Not all, very many of them had breast cancer. So it came out to a couple of 100,000 women. And they said, okay, we took all of the women in the cancer registry, starting in 1968. And abortion was legalized in Denmark, so we have a registry starting in 1973. Well, that was the first problem. They included women with breast cancer in the study that, by their own methodology, couldn't have had an abortion because it wasn't, according to them, legal until 1973. So for 6 years, they collected breast cancer cases that couldn't have had an abortion and included them in the study. But the worst thing that they did was to say abortion was legalized in 1973. It was not. In Denmark, it was legalized in 1939. So if you went to the vital statistic records that they have in Denmark, you would have found 60,000 women had abortions in Denmark before 1973. And those women included in their studies were listed as never having an abortion. So they misclassified 60,000 women.
So in other words, rather than being a flawless study, this is a deeply flawed study.
It was a deeply flawed study. That's correct. And it's kind of shocking that you would have a journal as prestigious as the New England Journal of Medicine that would put this kind of stuff out.
Well, this is peer-reviewed research.
Right.
And, you know, these people are not unintelligent, and they do know the difference between good research and bad research.
The other thing that they did was a quarter of the people in their study was less than 25. So this is what happens. Say you have an abortion and you're unlucky. That's caused one breast cancer cell to form. Well, cancer grows by multiplying, right? So one cell goes to two cells go to four to eight, etc. So the time it takes to go from one microscopic cell to something that's a half an inch, if it's an average cancer, it takes about 8 years to get to be the size that it's detectable. 8 years. So if you have an 18-year-old that has an abortion and she was unlucky, she had a cancer cell form, you're not going to find that cancer until she's at least 26. So if you start, if a quarter of your patients in the study are 25, they haven't had time enough to develop their cancer. That was another major flaw. There wasn't long enough follow-up time. But because of Janet Dehling's study in 1994, that showed this large increase in risk, especially in teenagers. She showed an 800% increased risk of breast cancer in some teenager groups. That created such a terrible, I guess it was a nightmare for the National Cancer Institute because they funded her or commissioned her study. And it made Time magazine. And so then 2 years later, Joel comes out with his meta-analysis, and it really looks like this is true, and it might do some damage.
Well, let's talk about this on the other side, Angela. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
There's nothing like a teenager. There's no challenge like a teenager. The teenage years are halfway between childhood and the adult world, with all the joys and the conflicts of both. How do we parent and guide our children in the Christian faith through this unique time of life? Faithfully Parenting Teens is the title of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. This book is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, to find out more about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens. issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call or go online, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens.
Genesis teaching. Now, when do we need it? Answers with Ken Ham, one of the authors of the best-selling Answers book. Well, Ken, how often should people hear teaching about the book of Genesis? Let me give you a practical example. At one of our Answers in Genesis conferences, a teacher came up to me and said something surprising. Her principal wouldn't let the students attend our special school assembly on Genesis. He insisted that because the school had attended our program a couple of years ago, they'd already heard the message and therefore didn't need to come again. Well, I said, think about this. We celebrate Easter and Christmas each year. The same stories about Jesus' birth and death on the cross, year after year. Do you ever get tired of hearing them? Well, we celebrate these important events so we won't forget them. We read the same passages of Scripture over and over again so we won't forget them. Look at the Israelites. No matter how much they were reminded of God's law, they still forgot. Most of us don't even remember what our pastor preached last week. You know, Genesis is foundational to the rest of the Bible. It's such an important book. We need to be reminded of its important truths over and over again, year after year, and we need to make sure we give that foundation to our children.
In fact, the Bible shares some valuable truths about the real history of the world, including the appearance and disappearance of dinosaurs. Find out more about what the Bible says about dinosaurs when you read Ken Ham's free booklet at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. For many people today, censorship has become a bad word. Directors, actors, and legal scholars continue to debate the finer points of artistic freedom and government censorship. But what do Christian parents do in the meantime? Regardless of where you stand on this issue on the national level, for Christian parents, censorship must be practiced in the home. The music our children hear, the video games they play, and the movies they watch can encourage drug abuse, sexual immorality, and even suicide. Jesus loves our children very much, enough to die on the cross for them. He does not want them to engage in any self-destructive behavior. It is our God-given responsibility as parents to protect our children from harm. So when it comes to censorship in the home, there is no debate. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
AM850KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Wednesday, November 10th, 2004, Sue Peterson. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM850KFUO in celebration of the birthday of the United States Marine Corps and in honor of all the men and women who are serving our country. Once again, we say thank you to Sue Peterson of Collinsville, Illinois, today's AM850KFUO day sponsor.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 10 more minutes in this conversation as we talk about breast cancer and abortion. Our guest, Dr. Angela Lanfranchi, is Assistant Clinical Professor of Surgery at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, co-founder of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute, and, of course, she's also author. We've been talking so much with the authors of the various chapters of this book, The Cost of Choice. She has a chapter there, too, called The Abortion Breast Cancer Links, The Studies and the Science. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. As usual, when talking about a subject of sensitive nature, feel free to call in anonymously, and we will honor your request. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You were in the middle of a thought, Dr. Lanfranchi, on the Melby study and the fact that what you're dealing with here is women, if they cut it off at 25 years old, they're dealing with women who have not yet had the, if they're unlucky, as you say, and develop a single cancer cell after their abortion, that has not come to the point where it would be detectable in under normal circumstances. Is that a good synopsis
of
what you're saying?
Based on the biology of breast cancer, an average doubling time, it takes 8 years to go from one cancer cell that continuously doubles at a certain rate to get to the size of a half an inch, which is usually what's felt to be the earliest clinically detectable breast cancer.
Now, you point out something else here, and it has to do with one of the criterion that we didn't mention here, the most basic of all, and that is the risk factor has to precede the actual supposed effect. And you say the Melby study started by tracking breast cancer rather than by tracking abortion.
That's right. It started collecting breast cancer cases in 1968. When by their own methodology, they were only considering abortions that occurred after 1973. So they had 6 years' worth of breast cancer cases that, by their own definition, couldn't have been exposed to abortion.
And in spite of this, and this is not often understood when people talk about the Melby study, in spite of this, the Melby study, even with its flaws, still found an increased risk?
Yes, in the second trimester, the risk was like 38% increased risk. Because it's really there, it's very hard to hide things when it's absolutely the biologic truth. You know, no matter how you twist and turn the numbers, you know, the truth keeps coming out, unfortunately, I guess, for... In February of 2003, the National Cancer Institute had a workshop on reproductive history and breast cancer, reproductive factors as it related to breast cancer, and it was really to discuss the abortion breast cancer link. And they came out quite conclusively that it was so not a link. Oh, there was so not a link there that they didn't even have to discuss it anymore. But what they had to admit to was something that they called a, quote, epidemiologic gap, which was premature deliveries before 32 weeks double breast cancer risk. They didn't quite understand why that was happening. So they had, how they're going to try to get away from the biology that's so clear in textbooks. Of what causes increased risk and what causes breast cancer. They just can't get away from it. So, for example, I had two textbooks edited by Landon Copeland, one published in 91 and one in 97, where in the chapter in molecular biology it clearly stated that first trimester abortions increase breast cancer risk. In the 2004 edition, they took that section out of the molecular biology section and addressed it in the epidemiology section. And in a table, they said abortion had no effect on breast cancer risk. But if you went and read the two paragraphs that they had in the chapter, it said that the Melby study found a 38% increased risk in the second trimester. So it was there in print. It wasn't there in the table. So even the textbooks are trying to maintain some sort of political correctness. I'll give you one other example of political correctness that they have about it. They talk about how do we reduce, what kind of public policies could we have to reduce breast cancer risk in this country. So one of the things I said earlier on the program was the sooner you have a full-term pregnancy, the lower your risk of breast cancer. So in the table, it talks about how exercise reduces breast cancer risk, and we could have a public policy of increasing sports programs in high schools and bicycle paths for people to bicycle to work. But in the text, it discussed that the main that they would get a lot of reduction if women had children earlier in life, if they weren't waiting until their 30s and, like me, waited till 41 to have a child, because education is so important in our culture that, of course, women can have children and get educated at the same time. Now, that's purely nonsense. They can have public policy to support women who have children while they're in college, you know, in terms of child care during classes and all sorts of things like that. But they don't want to address those issues. So I just found that pretty interesting. I think a lot of people said, oh, you know, pro-lifers are making this stuff up. Look, the National Cancer Institute, I mean, why would scientists not tell the truth about something like that? Well, it's a governmental agency. So in the early 1930s, there were a number of studies linking lung cancer and tobacco. And by the 1950s, it was pretty clear no one got lung cancer unless they smoked. They were clearly linked. But what happened was, because we had so many southern states whose whole economies was based on tobacco, you weren't going to have a governmental agency come out and say tobacco and lung cancer were linked. So they would downplay it.
Is something comparable happening with the National Institutes of Cancer?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. I used to think that it was because they really hadn't examined the literature. But now if you look at textbooks and you see how they word textbooks, and they absolutely don't want this material out because they think that it will deter people from having an abortion. And I found in my practice, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
With only about 30 seconds here, and finally, is there any question in your mind, having looked at this and having actually treated women with breast cancer and then looked at the research, across all the research, that there is a link between abortion and breast cancer?
There's no question in my mind that there's a link between abortion and breast cancer, that there's a very well-defined physiology for it, and that is just so simple and straightforward to understand that if your IQ is above 40, you can get it.
Dr. Angela Lanfranchi, thank you very much for being our guest.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Angela Lanfranchi, Assistant Clinical Professor of Surgery at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, co-founder of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute, and author of this chapter in the book Cost of Choice, The Abortion Breast Cancer Link, The Studies, and The Science. Now, you can check out the website for the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute. It's bcpinstitute.org, bcpinstitute.org. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. Two books. You can choose one of the two at $9.99 a piece plus shipping and handling. Faithfully Parenting Teens or Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. These are good resources for parents who are at that stage in life, those two difficult stages, preschool and the teen. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens or Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., who is Jesus according to the New Testament? Isn't that the real question? Dr. Charles Geeshan of Concordia Theological Seminary will join us to talk about that, the identity of Jesus in the New Testament. If you want to know who he is, you go to the documents that speak of him in a faithful and reliable way. That's what we'll do tomorrow with Dr. Charles Geeshan on the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.